This was Mercury retrograde, and we had invoked the devil and death, and you were traveling to do a Radio 8 Ball show, which is kind of my thing, and so I'm a bit of a fiery character, as you've mentioned on this show before. There were some conflicts. Did you want to address any of these?
I mean, not really. It was kind of a bummer.
Time at a big coincidence.
There's the holy moment, and then there's the awareness of trying to have the holy moment. In the same way that the film is the actual moment really happening, but then the character pretending to be in a different reality. And it's all these layers.
We think everything is separate, limited. I'm over here, you're over there, which is true, but it's not the whole truth, because we're all connected.
The time as of now is now. And you are listening to Synchronize, the weekly audio magazine exploring and highlighting the best in the synchronistic arts. Please set your minds to open.
Open the floodgate doors.
Andras Jones here. We got back from the Bay Area Sync Summit last week, and it's still just barely coming into focus for me. Lou Reed died sometime between our Radio 8 Ball show and the Bridge concert the following day. I saw Lou Reed in the World Trade Center in 1992 at the CMJ Music Conference when I was there with my band the previous. Lou Reed was one of the speakers, as was Jesse Jackson, and I remember Lou got into some kind of beef with Jesse and came off looking like something of a dick and maybe even a little bit racist. That was a long time ago, and I don't remember the details, and honestly, I don't care. I'm sure they don't. They're both awesome, and flawed, and awesome. I've been connecting the dots of my experience from our weekend in the Bay Area as I've been editing the shows, and since I initiated the whole damn thing and spent a good deal of the event experiencing it from the vantage point of its center, I feel that my experience may provide some useful piece of the sync puzzle. At this point, I'm going to assume that you have heard the recording of the event, as well as perhaps the episode of 42 Minutes in which Doug Bowles and Will Morgan interview Joe Alexander about the week's events. If you've listened to these two podcasts, you'll probably agree that the event sounds as if it was a success, and it was, but not an unqualified success, nor one which is as simple or as cheery as we have let on. The critical listener may have noticed some mischievous insider giggling on the 42 Minutes episode, and the highly intuitive among you may even have heard intimations of conflict in the Radio 8 Ball show or even in my set of songs. There was a conflict. Like Lou Reed in 92 at the WTC, I got into a beef with Justin Morgan, the artist who created the cover for my book Accidental Initiations, as well as all the Sync book covers to date. Now, he's no Jesse Jackson, and I'm no Lou Reed, and the Monkey House Theater in Berkeley is about as far from the World Trade Center as you can get in terms of time, space, and body count. But we had a beef, and it's the thing that everyone in our little group seems to be vibrating around and not mentioning, and, well, that kind of mitigating niceness just makes me sick. And like a natural human being, when I get sick, I vomit. And since I'm an artist, sometimes when I vomit, it sounds like this, and gets all over your pretty little brain. I referenced it in my question. I honestly try and be easy. But even at this fantastic event, at the after party, when I wanted to be hanging out with all the cool syncsters and old fans of my music, instead I end up in a fight. Not with fists, but with words. And even though I was the one being disrespected and whose boundaries were being way overstepped, I ended up coming off looking like an asshole and having to leave my own party, only to return to an empty house. As a performer and as a producer, you put so much into an event like this, and you can't really enjoy it until after. To have the peace of this event marred by unnecessary conflict really knocked me out psychically for the rest of the trip, in part because of what happened, and in part because there was no one in our group who could or would let me talk with them about it. This dynamic is really wonderfully demonstrated in Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm. Over and over, Larry gets offended by situations in his life that are illogical or hypocritical or petty, and when he mentions the offense, he ends up getting targeted or excluded. We laugh because it's true, and because he's rich, and because he's kind of a genius, and because in the show, his character is honestly pretty terrible. In reality, as with most comedy, it's a lot more subtle and universal, and it hurts. Now, is that anti-Semitism? It's a loaded word, but yes, when it happens to a Jew, it is anti-Semitism. And if that Jew says this feels like anti-Semitism, that's a good time for people who want to understand this poorly named phenomenon that has guided so much of the Christian era to pay attention. At very least, not to mock and belittle and accuse and exclude said Jew with coded words like paranoid, intense, crazy, and even abrasive. We get into a lot of this in the following episode, but we never just say it. There was a kerfuffle, and it's no big deal. Or at least, I hope it's less of a big deal now that it can be spoken of just like any other sink. And best of all, now you are in on what the rest of us are in on. I hope that this enhances your experience and relieves any cognitive dissonance you may have felt, as if a storm was brewing somewhere in the distance and you never got to hear the thunder, or even hear about the thunder. Sync is real, my friends, and that means, at least to me, that there's nothing to hide or be embarrassed about. From the center of my sync to the center of your sync, ain't nothing new under the sun but your perspective. This has been mine. I invite you to warm your imagination by the fire of my outrageousness.
This is Joe Alexander from Barely Human on YouTube, and you're listening to Sync Book Radio from thesyncbook.com.
When we last wrapped up Synchronize, we had talked about Tom Waits as the devil card. We evoked imagery of suicide, Jesus, vampires. So as I was leaving the East Coast, flying all the way to the other side of the country to actually see what would come of not only the concert, but our sync event, I didn't know exactly what to expect. The only thing I really knew was that there was one t-shirt that I had to wear on that night. It's a t-shirt that features a bridge in New York City called the Hellgate Bridge. For sync heads, it's most significant as if you're watching the film Rosemary's Baby. The film starts with a panning view of the New York City skyline, and then the title, Rosemary's Baby, comes up on screen, superimposed over this bridge. To me, an obvious hint that Roman Polanski is putting Rosemary's Baby on the Hellgate Bridge, or the bridge to the underworld and things like that. Well, knowing that we were kind of playing with underworld imagery with our event, or if we weren't playing with it, we were certainly resonating with it, I felt like, well, that's the t-shirt I need to wear on the night of the event. And that was really the as much forethought as I had, or any kind of expectations, was it just felt like to complete the shamanic magic was to wear the shirt. I think a really important piece of context for the show is that the stage was set as a graveyard, and this is because our musical guest, Ira Marlowe, is doing a show on that stage that was, I believe, running about a month, which takes place in a cemetery. And he said, well, you can do the show at this venue, just know that the stage is set up as a cemetery, just as our New York event was a similar situation, only it was set up as a dog park, which has its own set of synchronicities. So, you know, knowing that it was a cemetery, and I knew that in advance, hence the t-shirt, but it amazed me that at no point during the show did we actually vocally acknowledge it. Yeah.
So, now, one of the things, there were some, this was Mercury retrograde, and we had invoked the devil and death, and you were traveling to do a Radio 8 Ball show, which is kind of my thing, and so I'm a bit of a fiery character, as you've mentioned on this show before. There were some conflicts. Did you want to address any of these?
I mean, not really. It was kind of a bummer. I felt like it was a shame, and it certainly killed the mood in a lot of ways. But if I were to say anything about it, is that I asked you the next day if you thought there was any possibility that we sort of, you know, through our sloppy chaos magic, if we didn't kind of invoke this confrontation in the sense, you know, I mentioned some of the songs that you play in your opening set, and just my own, we're playing with dangerous archetypes. It's one of the things that I'm, every time I sit down to work on Suicide Kings, there's this, the artist in me that wants to say, like, fuck everything, just write an awesome book. And there's this nagging little voice in the back of my head that says, like, you're playing with really dangerous archetypes. I just hope that no one gets hurt. And in that sense, I guess I was left with, on a sink / magical ritual level, wondering if we didn't invite this. And then on a very practical level, you know, feeling somewhat responsible because I felt like, hey, I could bring you two together and you guys could, everything could be cool. And, you know, we could all just be groovy, happy sink heads together. So feeling partly responsible on a practical level and then on a more synchronicity level.
Is there anything else that you would ask yourself if you were me doing this interview?
Was it worth it?
Alan Green. Was it worth it?
Oh, fuck yeah. You know, the trip out there was pretty intense. It's not just flying. It was the whole way of how I had to get to the airport and how we had to leave so far in advance just to take a day and a half to travel there. I mean, it was just, it's, I don't want to get into it all, but it was just such an intense travel experience. And then we, as soon as we landed, David Plate picks us up at the airport. We drive down to Santa Cruz. We're hanging out with him. And, you know, then, like, the next day, drive to San Francisco, meet up with you for a short while. Just constantly running around, and not really sleeping and feeling really burned out. Then we fly back to North Carolina. I get home at midnight. I have to be at work at 9:45 the next day to do a 12-hour shift. And because I took all these days off, I have to do a series of 12-hour shifts all in a row, which I'm just coming home from one at the moment as we record this. And I'm just so burned out. And yet every time I think about how tired I am, my thought to myself is, but it was so worth it. Like, it was just such a wonderful experience. And as tired as I am, and as much, you know, as a, much of a financial expense as it was to travel, and obviously, you know, the conflict on Saturday night and things, anything that you could paint negative on it, it couldn't even begin to tarnish the experience.
We came there to do the Radio 8 Ball Bay Area Sync Summit and to have all these great connections and conflicts and lessons to learn and to do our sloppy chaos magic. But what initiated this trip and what was the theme of our last Synchronize was Tom Waits and his performance at Neil Young's Bridge concert. Please tell the audience a little bit about the experience.
Tom Waits' set was fantastic, and it was definitely the highlight of the entire... I mean, it was almost a 12-hour concert, and Tom Waits definitely stole the show. It's not anything that's my own personal bias here. It seemed like everyone that I spoke to there was waiting for Tom Waits, and we saw that after Tom Waits played, how much that place cleared out.
And he was the only one who, when his name was announced, a cheer went up from the crowd, like beforehand.
Right.
When his name showed up on the screen, up next, Tom Waits, all of a sudden, all these people who were kind of tired and drunk up till then, it seemed like, the audience was pretty lethargic and just sort of happy, but not enthusiastic, turned into a crowd.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. From a sync perspective, there were things like Jenny Lewis's opening song called Run Devil Run, which she was basically the first musician up. So since we had framed this whole concert in the respect to the devil, the fact that the first real song of the concert was Run Devil Run seemed like, okay, we sunk the sync battleship. You know? All right, you know, what do we do, go home? Like, it's done.
Run, devil, run. Devil, run. Devil, run. Run, devil, run. Devil, run. Devil, run. Run.
Up next, Douglas Bowles, co-host of the SyncBook radio program 42 Minutes, follows up on some of the material covered in our last episode of Synchronize, Episode 4.
Something uncanny happened on the way to the Bridge School benefit concert, namely, Synchronize number 4 and its related fallout. You see, both Alan and I worked independently on our respective audio essays, but converged upon a similar point. He spoke of the devil, and I spoke of a dark transcendence. Our medium was vampires, yet eventually we ended up making the same point.
My salvation depends upon it.
Your salvation?
Yes. I need lives. I need lives for the master.
Master for what, master?
The master will come, and he has promised to make me immortal.
How?
Tom waits. He still waits. Wants me to finish, actually. The film at the center of this uncanny convergence is Bram Stoker's Dracula by Francis Ford Coppola. It's fascinating to me that I made my point with vampires from the Twilight series, prompted from the Victoria Nelson text. But one may have found the same revelations of this genre just as easily within the Coppola film, although it does double duty. Some of the most important syncs noted in the past Synchronize episode were the idea of No Man, the Bridge, the German Jesus Serpent coin, and the famous Joseph Campbell quote about traveling to fight a monster. Had I used Bram Stoker as my source material for my audio essay instead of the Stephanie Meyer, a la Victoria Nelson, I would have to add one more very important point to the list, namely, the idea of losing one's head.
Ah! Flip their head!
Let's back up, though. During last year's march toward the end of the world, last December, I accidentally found that the major arcana of the tarot were encoded in the days of the month, noting the distinct qualities of the various cards each day. The poetry of this exercise was the coincidence of the World card and the End of the World on the 21st. What this facilitated in me was a look at our larger moment. Do years themselves also have a quality? Or is that too generalizing? Can a whole year take on and have a distinct feeling? Well, you know, we did kind of start keeping track at 00 party over oops at a time.
I was dreaming when I wrote this. Forgive me if it goes astray.
But when I woke up this morning, could have sworn it was judgment day.
Sky was all purple, there were people running everywhere.
Trying to run from my destruction.
And that magician card was a bit of a doozy. But specifically, 2010, a wheel? 2011, justice or strength, depending? But 2012 was a hanged man. There's something strange about that year. And I should point out that when the fruit is ripe, it must fall. This is a letting go to death. And that is where we are now, what we've been doing all year since our 12-21 apocalypse of last year. Tom waits for no man. Alan explained all about it. Yet the curiosity I found is the literal concrete example of the German Jesus coin with the crucified serpent. Think on that a bit. It's the Keanu Gary Oldman duality. Mr. Anderson, Neo, the One, the New Man versus Dracula, the Devil, Saturn, the Old Man. Now think again on that Joseph Campbell quote. And where we had thought to find an abomination, we shall find a God. Where we had thought to slay another, we shall slay ourselves. Where we had thought to travel outward, we shall come to the center of our own existence. And where we had thought to be alone, we shall be with all the world. One of the elements on one of my blogs is a snippet of this quote under an image of Gary Oldman and Winona Ryder from Dracula during his death scene. Funny. I decided to read the Bram Stoker as well. I wanted to sink in deeper. It was good. Like Jaws and Moby Dick, it's a monster tease that kept you in the dark, waiting for the monster to come. The Coppola vision is whole in its quality, offering both the gothic and the romantic, both sides of the coin, as it were, combining their elements in a sexy, resplendent, emotional, over-the-top, sentimental, sensual explosion. It's so wrong, but exactly right. It's gothic, baby. As I said, the interesting sink that came of all this was the loss of one's head. This point was emphasized in both the novel and the film, that to eliminate the monster, you needed to remove its head. And thus I was prompted into finding a quote from Mike Ripel. I read here from Mutants and Mystics. I cannot help but think here on of Having No Head, a stunning little manifesto written by a British gentleman named D.E. Harding, who discovered while hiking in the Himalayas that consciousness was not the same thing as the brain, and that he had no head. Headlessness is also a common mystical trope in the Indo-Tibetan Hindu and Buddhist Tantra, where decapitated heads are pretty much everywhere in the iconography and art. To lose one's head, that is, to know that one is not one's brain, is to be enlightened. The next age superbody is, once again, a tantric body. Sound familiar? See, Tom Waits for No Man. 2013, or death, is a bridge. To transcendence? Maybe. Our next card is temperance, balance. So next year will likely be a little more even-handed. But until then...
Off with your head! Dance till you're dead! Head to roll! Head to roll! Head to roll! On the floor!
This is Chipper Dog from Sky Blue Symposia. You're listening to Sync Book Radio from thesyncbook.com.
You know, it's one thing to go to a concert and enjoy the music, and that's always great, usually great, unless the band really sucks. But to be there with my wife, with you, Andras, with Ira, with Violator, and then later...
To have Joe Alexander... come in like Han Solo at the end of the movie. It was fucking great.
Yeah. So when Tom Waits takes the stage, here I have all this anticipation about seeing Tom Waits for the first time. And then I had said to my wife, I don't know if it was just, I don't know, before the concert or maybe before we left, I said I was really glad that the first time I was going to get to see him, that I was going to get to share that experience with her. That was special to me. Then at some point I looked around and realized I had all these friends that I got to share this experience with, and friends that some of them I hadn't even met before that weekend, but that I felt immediately very close to. And the thing, when you meet a sinkhead, it's sort of like, oh, we know each other. It seems so natural, like, oh, I've known you for 30 years.
So yeah, when you meet a sinkhead, it is like meeting a cat, a fellow cat in a jazz that most people are not hearing.
Yeah, I would even relate to it as, you know, kind of like meeting a member of your tribe. Bill Klaus always talks about that, basically, after you've had this experience, what's the next thing you're supposed to do? And it's find the others. It felt like finding the others if you just kind of met this person that you already knew, if that makes sense. On Thursday, I got to meet David's rabbi, who I've heard so much about. And we only got to spend about an hour together, but to get to meet this guy, this was someone else who I've heard so much about. And it wasn't exactly the same thing as, okay, meeting someone that you feel this instant connection with, and it's like you've known each other for 30 years. This was, I was meeting someone who I had heard a lot about, and he was meeting someone that he had heard a lot about, but we had never actually even interacted through an email or anything. So that was a different experience, but a variation on it, and a really a wonderful one, and I was so happy to have that opportunity.
Were there any other high points from the show that you want to mention?
You had asked me if there was a synchronicity that I thought that only a sync head would be able to appreciate from this weekend. There was something that I didn't even really fully catch till I was on the plane ride home. On Sunday night after the concert, I ended up staying at Joe Alexander's hotel room. He had a hotel room that he wasn't staying at in Oakland and offered it to me since I needed a place to sleep. So you were with me, Andras, and me, you, Violator, and Melissa walk into this hotel, and there's a bunch of cops there. And it was a kind of, you know, just a moment to take pause. It very much felt like Fear and Loathing, going into the police convention. But there was only, I don't know, five or six cops around. It was pretty late at night. And that just felt like paranoia or something. Well, the next morning, go downstairs, there's even more cops. And the cops just kind of kept multiplying. Well, I saw in the elevator a little calendar of events, and it said something about Urban Shield. And then I was on the plane ride coming home, and the gentleman in front of me, like in the seat in front of me, I could see he was on his iPhone, and he was sorting his Urban Shield files on his iPhone. And it was just this horrendously militant photo of like a cop pointing this giant gun/taser thing out of the screen. You know, it said Urban Shield, you know, all dressed in SWAT gear and just like, I'm gonna fuck you up. I'm a Nazi and I'm gonna fuck you up, was this image. And this was obviously someone who had participated in the event, and this was some sort of official image for the event. And I'm like, what the hell is this thing? So I got home and I Googled Urban Shield. It was apparently some sort of giant police summit where they were training, like a Homeland Security training for EMT and different first responders, that they can have a SWAT-like response and help, I don't know, fight terrorism or whatever the hell. Something that you can probably tell by hearing me talk about it that I find kind of repulsive. The big sink for me there that I don't know if anyone else would have caught was that we've talked about this idea that whenever there's a sort of dichotomy, the Apollo-Dionysus dichotomy that Nietzsche wrote about. And it's the idea is that whenever there's a Dionysian movement, there's an Apollonian movement that counterbalances, or vice versa. These two things are always kind of happening in tandem. So I realized we had our very Dionysian sync summit weekend, and here the Homeland Security Gestapo were having their equivalent. And to me that was another type of validation, although perhaps a type of validation that I'm less excited about, but pretty intense synchronicity for me.
It's funny because you just blew my mind when you mentioned Urban Shield, because obviously I just went and looked it up. And the first thing on their page is the Boston Marathon bombing, which was the theme of our first Synchronize, which was in response to that event in a lot of ways, and featured the Boston Red Sox, who just won the World Series yesterday, Today is Halloween 2013. And the sink of the Urban Shield Gestapo's being there and that taking us back to our first synchronized, which is the main sync that I've been getting, is that this two-part episode in the fall at the end of this first run is really the end. We picked the death card because this is the end of that first run of our synchronizes, which started in April. And it's now October, which is the time to harvest, which is, in our case, to harvest synchronicities, harvest insights. And in our strange case, it's happening in a cemetery.
Well, the folks that died in Waco, man, they never got their turn. Well, the folks that died in Waco really bad enough to burn. A pretty good day in the U.S. of fucking A. I got my hands full, I barely got my rent paid. I worked down at the landfill, and last night I got laid. The folks that died in Waco, they were waiting on the Lord. Instead, they met the lead of another Roman sword.
As in all of my sync work, because I come to it as a Jew, as a Jewish person, as a Jew, what the hell, as a Jew, it sounds cooler. A Jewish person sounds horrible, but as a Jew, as I come to it as a Jew, and one of the things that I come up against is some of the awesomeness that comes with that and some of the difficulty that comes with that. And it's inherent, that goes very much to the question that I asked when I asked my question during Radio 8 Ball, which is a very Jewish kind of question, which is like, I try to be easy with people, and no matter what I do, people get mad. You know, I'm Larry David, you know, I'm Woody Allen, I'm Abby Hoffman, I'm Lenny Bruce, I'm fucking Jesus, whoever, whatever Jew it is that is saying, look, I'm just trying to say it in the nicest way, this is the way things are, and I'm just trying to be nice. Oh, damn, now you're freaking out, motherfuckers. Now, and depending upon if you're Abby Hoffman or Jesus, you're going to say, oh, put me up on your cross, if that's the story you want to believe that they tell after the fact, because it's easy to talk for someone after they're dead. But that's a whole other point. This is my thing. This is what I come into everything with, and every, thinking Jew of that particular stripe does. And it's not that the one thing you can say about us Jews is that there is not we're not alike in any way other than that other people seem to sometimes deal with us in similar ways, and then we have to make our own strange ways to deal with that. I don't know if that makes a lot of sense. I know it's the kind of thing where it would make sense if you're Jewish. And sometimes if you're not, it doesn't make sense. And one of the things that my question was, why, no matter how much I try and be easy, why do I keep attracting the really, to me at least, emotionally or psychically violent reaction of people who misinterpret that thing? And the song I got was Baltic Avenue, and I when I don't have an answer, I tend to go with the pun, because I find that the pun often reveals the truth. And in the case of Baltic, it was easy to say, oh, well, maybe I'm beset with Baltics. But then in reflection, I've also had to accept that it's possible that maybe I am a Baltic. Either, you think about the Abby Hoffmans and the Lenny Bruces and the agitator types that I gravitate to, the Thomas Paines of the world. You don't have to be Jewish to be a Baltic. It just helps if you are, maybe. And Lou Reed, also, he's kind of a Baltic. I don't want to put a pejorative on it when I'm doing the interpretation, but I am. But that was one of the big sinks for me going into it was, well, not no, not going into it. Going into it, you never think that that's going to be the sink. The going into it as a Jewish person, as a Jew. Man, I always want to say as a Jewish person. It sounds bad. As a Jew, you go into any of these things hoping that none of this is going to be an issue, going to be a problem, that you're going to find your tribe, right? But then, inherently you encounter these things, especially if you're the kind of I guess, the kind of Jew that I am. That, you know, and again, I don't want, you know, actually, I don't want to not compare myself to Abbie Hoffman and Lenny Bruce, and I don't want to compare myself to them either, other than that they are people who inspire me, as well as the other people I mentioned.
I'd like you to address that point right there, though. You said, you know, you would hope to feel like you found your tribe, and obviously the word, that very word even is a loaded word in the realm of Jewishness, but did you feel, or when you get together with sync heads, do you feel, I said I felt like I am with my tribe, do you feel that way?
I do, up to a point, honestly.
Yeah, go for it.
I do, I feel like I find my tribe in terms of sync when I'm doing that, and people's capacity for sync is different. Like, if you're really, I'm sure if Joe meets another basketball player, and it doesn't have to be a professional basketball, just someone who gets the inner games and the rhythms of this thing that he's great at. But it's like hanging out with Ira. Ira Marlowe is not a sync head in any way, but he's a great musician, and he has a lot of the context I have. And so when I hang out with Ira, there's a sense of I totally get him, and we get each other on this deep level of music and a particular kind of being a songwriter that very few other people get over a long term in the way that we have. And so we can watch a show like the Bridge Concert and gather some deep syncs because we're recognizing things. And at the same time, he's a little bit dismissive of sync. Sync isn't for everybody, nor is being a songwriter, nor is anything.
This is James Evan Pawato from Media Monarchy, and you're listening to Sync Book Radio from thesyncbook.com.
Up next, Alan interviews Jeremy, who prefers to keep his last name to himself. Jeremy is an author from the Sync Book Volume 1, who also writes under the name Violator Hellspawn at thestygianport.blogspot.com.
Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us today on Synchronize.
Thank you for having me, Alan.
Yeah, of course. It was great seeing you last weekend. I'm so glad that you made the trip to the Bay Area, that you were able to come to the Sync Summit on Saturday night, and that you even came with us to the Bridge Benefit Concert on Sunday. It was just a real pleasure getting to meet you in person and spend some time with you. I'm curious what your reaction was to getting to meet a few Sync heads, as Joe Alexander said, in the flesh.
Yeah. yeah, it was nice putting a face to all the names. I guess Andres is probably the only person I would recognized from his show, but yeah, it was cool meeting everyone and hanging out and just talking sync with people who understand it.
The event on Saturday night, were there any moments or any Radio 8 Ball song answers or anything that stand out to you as a particularly significant thing? Bear in mind that we are releasing the audio from the show, so people will get to hear that, but is there something that you feel like people wouldn't be able to get through listening to it that only someone being in the room would actually be able to appreciate or observe?
I don't know. Are you hinting at something?
I'm really not.
Is there a person specifically wearing that black shirt that you want to mention?
No.
No, I don't.
It really isn't a leading question at all.
Yeah.
If I can jump in here, I think it's more like, was there any particular sync that was personal for you at the event that maybe didn't get covered in terms of spoken about on stage? You had your moment on stage.
I thought it was funny that the eighth song was what, Cemetery? And we were in a cemetery, basically. But that was the one song that didn't come up, you know, during the 8-Ball show, because it had the headstones and the skeleton and everything set up there. And then when I went up there, the girl asked, like, where am I right now or something like that. But she was asking, like, more of with emotions. And I was just praying in my head, like, please be cemetery, because it would just be so funny that we're literally in a cemetery. Well, prop cemetery, I guess. But, yeah, I think it was the only thing I could think of that people wouldn't get, I guess, just listening to it.
Any particular synchronicities that you recognized on Sunday at the concert?
Not really. I mean, the only thing is, like we were talking about earlier, is the design, that sort of heart-shaped logo looks like a planchette, since we were talking about Ouija boards and stuff, that there's that huge planchette-looking, you know, Ouija board finder or whatever that was all over the place there. That was, like, the main thing that stuck out. A weird piece of scenery.
Yeah, it's actually, it was a funny synchronicity for me, because before leaving North Carolina, I saw a band poster that was done up Ouija board style, and I was like, oh, that's a really cool idea. And so that was just before I left, and then we got there, and when I went to Justin Morgan's house on Friday night, he had a little pumpkin carving party. And they had a Ouija board sitting out. No one actually took it out and played with it, but there was a little bit of conversation with the Ouija board. And then when we went to the event on Sunday, I looked at that event, that Heart with the Wings, which, by the way, I've mentioned a few times, there is a cartoon called Cardcaptor Sakura. It's an anime cartoon, which is the most blatantly esoteric occult thing that I have witnessed. It is Crowley into the max. And that's actually her logo, is the heart with the wings. Anyway, I saw that logo and I commented to you, that looks like an Egyptian sun disc. Instead of the winged
right.
sun, it's a winged heart. And it was you who commented back that it actually looked more like a planchette from a Ouija board. Now, what's interesting is that during Tom Waits' set, I had this kind of weird synchronicity where I almost felt like I was in contact, or that I was getting a message from one of my dead relatives. And then Tom Waits did this little bit where he's talking about family reunions.
You know, the trouble with family reunions is everyone wants to talk to you. That's the worst part. I don't mind seeing everybody, but please. So, what are you going to do? People that know you keep wanting to see you. Even those on the other side. I mean, the other side. I got a lot of them back there, okay. So do we all.
And he says, and it's particularly weird when they're on the other side and they want to talk to you. So he even referenced explicitly the dead relatives talking. I'm curious if that means anything to you in particular, or maybe if you just want to speak about the very idea of a Ouija board. Is that something that you think has any validity?
Yeah, actually, while you were talking, slightly off topic, but your avatar on Skype right now is the Look at All the Happy Creatures book with a gate with a heart shape, like iron design in the middle that kind of matches the, doesn't have the wings on it, but it's basically the same shape. Anyways, yeah, funny thing is I was talking about Ouija boards recently in Chris Meyer's group on Facebook, the Magic Group. And then, like, right when I got back, like, one of the first conversations in that group was again Ouija boards. I don't know why it's been coming up a lot lately. But yeah, I think there's, I mean, like, I went to a family reunion, since we're talking about family reunions. I went to a family thing when I was really young, and some uncle's, like, girlfriend drew a Ouija board and we played with it. I don't really remember if it worked or not, but I think there is validity to that. And a lot of people seem like, I mean, a lot of people in my family especially are scared of these things nowadays, the divination things, because they're all usually accurate. And like I was telling you and your wife about the baby thing I do with the pendulum. And now I combine that with automatic drawing.
Yeah, maybe you can explain that for people, what you mean by that.
Well, if anyone's into, well, if anyone wants to know what, oh, I don't know if I should tell. it's one of those things, like, you don't know if you should tell everyone, because would that take away the power or whatever, but it's basically like, it's you use a pendulum, and instead of holding it over the pregnant belly, you could do it at any time, you know, from when, probably as soon as the kid's born, I would imagine, but maybe after puberty or something. But at any age, whether they've had kids already or not, and it'll tell you how many kids are going to have and what their gender is going to be. And it always gives the same answer, and it's only for kids that are born. So if the stillbirth or an abortion or anything like that, if your baby's abducted at 3 months old by gray aliens or whatever, it won't show it on the pendulum thing. It just shows kids that are born. And it's always accurate. That's one of the things we do in our family that people are scared to do these days, because you never, because it's kind of embarrassing if, you know, two people are together and, like, my cousin got married, and him and his wife, I swear, have different results, which means basically they're not going to have kids together, or they'll have one kid together and get separated and she'll have another kid or something like that. So I try to refrain from doing it now. But like I was telling you, I combine that with sort of the planchette, which is the older automatic drawing tools, where it's like a planchette, but it's raised up on two pegs, and then the third peg is a pencil that you put through and screw into place, and you put your hands on it and let it move around just like you would on a Ouija board, and it draws. So, well, I didn't have one of those, but I just took a pencil and kind of held my hand out loosely and let it do its thing. And so I did the pendulum thing and combined it with the automatic drawing. And so when it gave the result for a girl, which would be on my hand a counterclockwise circle, instead it drew what looked just like full lips, looked like girl's lips. So it was an obvious girl picture. I mean, it was, you know, oriented exactly as you would draw a girl's lips. And then when I gave the second result, which for me would be a boy, it did a kind of oblong vertical shape with a smaller oblong shape coming off of it, like the pillar of Hermes, or just be like a pillar with a smaller stick for the phallus, like they used to put in the Roman crossroads. So it was a, you know, it's a male symbol. It's a boy. So I'm going to have a girl and a boy, and I already know that from the pendulum thing. And when I did the automatic drawing, it gave the same results. And then the third result, I think, is the most interesting, and it kind of reminds me of the logo you used with the snake eating the apple. It's like an Ouroboros and an apple. So the third result, since I'm not going to have any more kids past that, would just be a null. The needle or the pendulum wouldn't move. But when drawing, it actually drew out what I could only describe as an Ouroboros and a tiny figure eight on its side. So it drew Ouroboros, then infinity, then Ouroboros, infinity, and it just kept doing that over and over again, which was completely unexpected and totally just, I wasn't even looking at the paper. I was just letting the pencil move on its own, and it kept drawing the shape over and over again. So I think there's, I mean, that speaks to either reincarnation or some sort of, you know, continuation past physical death. I don't know exactly what it means, but it was an interesting result, and I think that there is something to letting your unconscious mind kind of open up, whether you're using a Ouija board or not. And sometimes the answers could be scary or not what you wanted. But I don't know. I recommend people experiment with it and tap into the dark forces and go to hell like me. Whatever your parents told you would happen. Actually, one of the other things I do, since we're on this topic, is egg divination. You put an egg into a glass of water on New Year's. And, well, I think you could do it whenever, but my family just does it on New Year's, and it shows you what's going to happen the next year. And so it's come up with, like, a casket shape, and that person died, or there's blood in the egg, and that person was really sick that year. So people, again, are scared to mess with these forces and see what's coming. But I got a thing in the mail once that was addressed to me specifically, and I open it up, and the first thing is kids putting an egg into a glass of water and says, like, basically, if you do this, you're going to hell, you know? Like, oh, well, that's interesting. But yeah, I think there is something to that kind of stuff, and people should, you know, experiment with it.
Speaking of hell, your avatar that you write under, Violator Hellspawn, you do something where you capitalize certain letters, and it's something I've always been curious about. Is there any meaning to the specific letters that you capitalize?
Well, in Violator, I capitalize the V and the R just because it looks cool, essentially. But in Hellspawn, since it comes from, it's really not, Violator isn't a Hellspawn. The Hellspawn was his you know, enemy in the comic books was Spawn. And it, the word is kind of a play on words because it could be Hell's Pawn or Hell Spawn. Oops, my phone's ringing. 1 second. So basically that's why I capitalize the letters, just so it gives both definitions could be applied, that I'm both Hell's Pawn and that I'm a Spawn of Hell, or, you know.
Interesting, whatever. Okay. It was that phone call from Malbolgia, or...?
Actually, it was it was an alarm to remind me to feed the dog, so...
Gotcha. Well,
dog was already fed. Everything's good.
Well, it is certainly time to feed the dog, and by that, I mean, let's play Radio 8-Ball.
We feel like we're channeling Andras.
Yeah. Are you there, Andras? Give us a yes. Give us a no.
Speak to us from beyond.
Hey, this is Bobby Hill, and you're listening to Radio 8-Ball with Andras Jones. I said good day, Sheriff.
And welcome to Radio 8-Ball. I'm Andras, your facilitator of pop oracling, and we're going to be using the music of Lou Reed, 16 songs selected by Alan, and one of them, randomly chosen, will answer Jeremy's question, which we don't know what that is yet. I just wanted to point out that, interestingly, well, when you were talking about the gender of the girl's lips being drawn, it made me think, well, it could be a girl, or it could just be Lou Reed in 1969.
I really hope my future wife doesn't give birth to a 1969 Lou Reed.
You could do worse.
I mean, not if he comes out full grown like that.
No, but I guess I'm thinking that we're inviting in an artist who part of his work has been in dissolving some of the traditional gender roles. So I just thought that was interesting, and that you were having the conversation that it could muddy the waters as far as your particular divination. At any rate, what is your question for the Pop Oracle?
Since I'm going to keep it personal, since that seems to work best for Radio 8-Ball, or for Pop Oracle, it's going to be, where should I be focusing my energy right now? So should I go back to school or get a second job or really dive into writing? Like, what at this fork in the road, which direction should I take? Where should I be focusing my energy?
Okay, well, we're going to pick a song at random, and we'll see what we get. Sunday Morning.
Sunday morning brings the dawn in. It's just a restless feeling my side, early dawning, Sunday morning, it's just the wasted years so close behind. Watch out, the world's behind you, there's always someone around you who will call. It's nothing at all. Sunday morning, and I'm falling. I've got a feeling I don't want to know. Streets you cross not so long.
And that was Sunday Morning from the Velvet Underground, and Nico, released in 1967, featuring Lou Reed, who passed away in between the nights of the 26th of October and the 27th of October 2013, which is between the two events we've been discussing. And that was the answer to Jeremy's question, where should he be focusing his energy in the coming days, weeks, and months ahead. Jeremy, what did you think about that as the answer to your question?
That was interesting. There's a few possibilities there. Interesting that it's Sunday morning, so it's like the middle of the weekend, basically. I mean, you know, you had nothing to do yesterday, nothing to do today kind of thing. And it also speaks to when Lou Reed died was kind of on the weekend between us doing things, like you just said. So it's kind of like a lull or a pause, I guess, between periods, you know, of life. Just a restless feeling by my side. So, yeah, okay, I feel restless about where to go from here. But it's kind of, I mean, it's just like, watch out, the world's behind you. It's you've gone past one period of life, I guess. One era, but it's just Sunday morning, you know, it's nothing at all. So it was kind of like, it's almost just saying, take it easy, you know, enjoy your time of not being not a hectic kind of life. I mean, I kind of like, you know, take it easy right now because I don't know what to do, I guess. So yeah, I don't know. It's kind of like, yeah, it was like speaking to where I'm at now. And then just, I don't know, just don't worry. There's someone around you who will call. So I guess wait for the call. I don't know if that's just my natural laziness and procrastination cutting into my my interpretation of the song or what.
Well, let's get Alan's take on it. Alan, what did you get out of that?
Yeah, so Lou Reed did die Sunday morning, on a Sunday morning. It's the first track on the Velvet Underground and Nico album, which I think is interesting. It sort of totally bookends Lou Reed in the sense of sort of launching his career and when he actually died. I think that's pretty interesting in and of itself as an answer. As far as the answer, yeah, there was definitely things. The first minute, I mean, the lyrics were just sort of so, you know, almost give me chills of like, he's definitely talking about trying to figure out what to do and all the different directions that it could go. The one line that I found particularly interesting was he said, there's a feeling I don't want to know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all these other things where it would seem like to be cautious. If he says, watch out, the world's behind you. So it's not like, hey, the world's got your back, but watch out. You know, you have to watch out because the world is kind of riding your ass, if you will. But then there's also, like you said, you know, it's nothing at all. Like, don't worry. I definitely got that. But the line where he says, it's a feeling I don't want to know, was interesting, particularly, I was kind of meditating on it while the song was playing. And then when you said, is it my laziness? What is it? But I don't really know. It seems like I can kick back and kind of relax right now, but I don't really know. And I was wondering if it was almost like, I don't want to know.
That's funny because we're just talking about divination right before the song and how I was saying people in my family no longer want to know the results of these tests because they're too scarily accurate. So I got a feeling I don't want to know.
It seems like in your family, the reason that people are struggling with it is because of the sort of fear of hell, the fear of that duality. And in the line, the song, it says, he's talking about Sunday. That's the Lord's day, right? The Christian
right, yeah.
Sunday, and you're falling. Sunday, and I'm falling, and I don't want to know. And here you are playing with the very stuff that your family rejects in terms of giving yourself the name Hell's Pawn or Hellspawn, which are both, I think, sarcastic in some way. I would imagine you don't think of yourself as evil or a pawn of evil, but at the same time, you're invoking that and playing with that in the sense like what you were talking about with Ira's song that didn't get chosen, which is Don't Go in the Cemetery. You're someone who's very consciously choosing to go in the cemetery despite the warnings of your family, who are the world that's behind you saying, be afraid, don't, you know, watch out. You know, you're going to fall into hell.
Yeah, I mean, we're a Catholic family. Everyone's uber Catholic. My mom's aunt, I did a procession. We sing Happy Birthday to Jesus on Christmas morning, and we walked into the house holding tiki torches and miniature statues of Jesus. The very, very Catholic. And then there's that whole Catholic guilt and then Catholic fear of hell, since the Western world doesn't really deal with death in a really good way.
And here so you that. Have Lou Reed, who's a Jewish prophet, not unlike the Catholic Savior, who's singing lyrics that somehow challenge that same order that you're challenging as a child of it.
Yeah, Sunday morning and I'm falling. I like that. I'll have to meditate on this one some more.
I also think that it's pretty interesting. During the event, I pointed out the girl who asked the question that you decoded, Jeremy, her question was a lot about, like, ships. It was called Ship in a Bottle, right? Mm-hmm. And it was this idea of, like, being on this ocean voyage. And I point out that your blog's name, Stygian Port, is all about the River Styx, that sort of boat ride into hell. I think it's interesting, and this is a very obvious synchronicity, but the idea that the Velvet Underground, you know, it's the underworld.
There you go.
That's perfect.
This is Douglas Bowles from 42 Minutes, and you're listening to Synchronize with Andras Jones and Alan Green, a production of SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
Oh, I see what you're
doing. All right, take two. Here we go.
Really?
I have to do a couple of these. I feel like a D-I-C-K for not... I mean, it was a couple of weeks ago that he asked for these from us, Will.
I sent one in.
No so way.
I did now. I care for like a couple of times.
All right.
Joe's was badass.
Yeah,
though.
It was. This is what I'm like the standard. This is Douglas Bowles, the Goblin King of Winter's Labyrinth, and you're listening to Synchronize, a production of SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
I just realized something. Because you asked you framed your question in the scope of this woman who said, you said, was into the occult, and she said, I am not in a cult, right? Now, you have a chapter in your book, Accidental Initiations, talking about a balanced diet of cults, that you belong to many cults, and I think it's probably true for all of us, right? I find my tribe in sync with the sync heads. You might find your tribe with musicians, with other musicians. There are multiple tribes that we all belong to. We all have our family lives and our work lives and our this lives and that lives. So in the same way, this is the balanced diet of cults that you're really referring to here. And I think it's funny that this sort of emphasis is, I am not in a cult. I am not in a singular cult. Do you get what I'm
right.
saying?
My goal is to represent a multiplicity in every moment as an artist. That's what I think the best artists do. They hit you on all levels. That's at least seven chakras, and I'd say seven chakras times two, because you have a masculine and a positive and a negative, a masculine and a feminine of each. That's if I'm really working as an artist, I'm hitting you on 14 levels. You know, as a human being, that's just too much for anyone to handle. And I'm not saying that I'm doing that on a daily basis, but in general, I can only function on two levels without going crazy. Functioning on one level is maddening. Whatever conflict that happened is really less important to me than unpacking the dynamics, because there does seem to be an interesting relationship, at least, well, it's because I'm Jewish, I see this, between synchronicity and Jews. Ulysses, which was written by James Joyce and has some interesting synchronicities with my book, Accidental Initiations. And that's the only way you can compare my book to that one, is that it's a story of an Irishman hanging out with this Jewish guy and seeing the way anti-Semitism works. And I think there's something that is very, it's almost like you have to be a sinkhead to get it because it's subtle. We're not having a conversation about Israel here. We're not having a conversation about Jewish bankers. We're not having a global politics conversation. We're two working class artists. That's where this is coming from. This isn't a conversation about global politics or all the other stuff that anti-Semites like to really dig into. Conversations I generally try and avoid because I try and avoid anti-Semitism in my life, and those conversations are rife with them, and they barely touch on me because it's just nonsense, honestly. I mean, whatever, I think. But aside from that, this we're talking about the experience of one Jewish guy going to a place just like Bloom did in Ulysses with another guy who's not Jewish and having weird shit go on and coming back and telling the tale. That's the Ulysses. And you even referenced the Odyssey in the last episode.
Thank you. Yeah, I was biting my tongue.
Yeah, thank you. We'll get there. We always get there. So when I'm talking about anti-Semitism in the realm of our conversations, because it came up a little bit with Bill Klaus in that Always Record episode, and it came up in this recent confrontation, is that there are stereotypical ways that we see certain people, and a lot of it might be about the way they talk or an accent or an affect that is cultural. So we hear someone talk or see a certain way someone is, and we say that they're like a scary black guy because they fulfill a certain archetype, or that they're a bitchy woman, or that they're, you know, whatever. It feels disgusting to throw up these tropes. But another one is the abrasive Jew, the intense Jew, which is like, that's the Baltic thing where I was like, okay, well, I'm abrasive. You got to be abrasive to get rid of the Baltics. You got to be abrasive to be a Baltic. That's my answer one way or the other. And there's nothing wrong with that. Just like there's nothing wrong with being the kind of black guy that seems like a scary black guy to a prejudiced white person, or the being a bitchy woman is to the sexist guy who calls her that, or the anti-Semitic guy or woman who looks at me and when I'm just speaking the truth to you and being as easy as I possibly can be, can't help but hear a cult or o cult or hear whatever and see it as a threat, because there is something abrasive about me, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that seems like awesomely American, and so like every movie or rock song I've ever loved or wanted to be a part of. And yet that is what gets me in so much trouble, and I can't help, because I see it as a dynamic that doesn't just happen to me but happens to lots of Jews. In fact, it's in people who study this stuff, this is the literature. Words like intense, abrasive, dramatic, paranoid. They're coded language that Jews hear as Jew, because you hear it all the time from people who aren't Jewish, and you don't hear it from people who are. Unless they're people, Jewish people, who are so scared by anti-Semitism that they've taken on the like, oh, shush, 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 don't be Jewish. Don't be abrasive, intense, dramatic, paranoid. When, you know, you're all of those things, Alan.
Oh, I was just, that's what I say. It's like, I get called those things all the time. I've never felt like someone was saying that because they thought I was Jewish. I just assume that's probably the way I behave.
And I guess the difference is that when you say it to a Jewish person, it terrifies them. It means they're about to get fired, kicked out, beaten up, gassed, killed, you know, the lit, you know, you, we know we know the dominoes that can go in a person's mind who's two generations from the ovens. It's not like you want to carry that around. You don't want to carry it around, but it's there. And it's not even there in terms of that. It's there in terms of we've lost friendships. We've lost relationships. We've lost jobs, many of us who are Jews. And what's been put on the line is abrasive or da-da-da-da-da-da, these things.
So as I said to you the other day, I'm fully willing to admit I don't get it. I really don't get it, because like I said, that is my reality. I don't know if that's as a New Yorker or what, but I get called those things. And I'm like, well, I get called those things, and I'm not taking it so personally. But wait. What I'm acknowledging here is that I'm willing to admit that I don't understand, and I'm also willing to admit that in the context of this as a sync conversation, that, you know, when I was talking to this guy that I know around here, and I was relating the urban shield, like going into the hotel and probably smelling like marijuana in this elevator with all these police, and he's like, oh man, were you super paranoid? And I was like, no. And what I was really thinking was, no, because I'm in Oakland and I'm white and I really didn't think that the cops would fuck with me. And that's the real fucking truth there. It's like,
yeah,
you know, that's the advantage in that situation, is I don't have to feel paranoid. And in probably in the same respect, when someone calls me abrasive, I don't have to feel personally offended, because I'm like, yeah, okay, so I smoke weed, and oh yeah, okay, I'm abrasive, and okay, yeah, because they're probably, realistically, are not the same consequences. So I'm willing to accept that that's something I just don't get, because the consequences are different for me.
So, well, first of all, I want to acknowledge that's pretty awesome. I like this. Well, this is why I like working with you, because you are a true sinkhead. A true sinkhead is willing to look at their, like, oppression is a big piece of this whole game, because we live in an obviously oppressive society, and it's going to hit everyone differently based upon how they look, sound, or act, because that's how prejudice hits you. It hits you based upon first impressions. And that was the other interesting sink. I want to jump to it, because one of the things that also came up was the question that's come up many times, and it came up from my cousin who attended the show, which is, why are there mostly men in sync? And in the realm of sync book and sync and like a lot of the sync research. And I think we both gave the pat answer, which in retrospect, I kind of regret, which is on some level that women aren't interested in it.
Oh, I didn't mean that women aren't interested in it. I meant that women are experiential.
Women get it all. Yeah, women already get it. And so we're more like, we're these nerdy guys who are just playing with this. But I think this is wrong on both counts. I've been thinking about this. I do think that there is some, I think there's, it's right. Like, you know, like I said, I'm coming to you. I'm always coming on seven levels, at least two. So on one level, that's totally right, I think. But that's only in the way it's being expressed now. Because I think we're not just nerdy kids playing. I think a lot of the people who are working with synchronicity are people who are very embodied. David is an ecstatic person. David Plate is. Joe Alexander is fully embodied. He's an athlete. I know that I do a lot of embodiment work. You're just like, you're an animal. It's not a bunch of nerds who don't live in their bodies playing with cards. Like, we're playing with synchronicities. Like, we're embodied and balanced people on the way to being more embodied and more balanced. So I don't think it's good to downplay the work that men are doing in the realm of synchronicity, to say that there's this other thing that women already get that we're just getting. And I think it's true that on some level men in general are. But there is a larger question, and I don't think that you or I have an answer for it. And I think that's the real answer, is why aren't women more involved in sync? Well, that's a question only a woman can answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I can't tell you why you don't like me, right?
Right.
You know, and we're shit out of luck on that one. But I wanted to address that because it's on the same level of what I'm trying to talk about. Being involved in sync, the more context you have, the deeper the sinks you have. And oppression is a part of context. And when a woman asks you why there aren't more women involved, and you say, well, women just aren't into this, and we're doing something that's shitty, it's a thing that it's like downplays both men and women. And I only say this harshly to you because I said the exact same thing to her. And then when I heard you saying it, it rang so hollow because I had just said it that I was like, oh, wow, yeah. There's another piece here, which is like, why don't you tell me? You just were at a show.
Right. What did you get out of it? Did it speak to you?
Why aren't women into this? You tell me. You're that demographic. I'll tell you why angry Jews aren't into it. Right.
Back in May of 2013, Ezra Sanzerbel joined us on Synchronize Episode 1 to decode the Mick Jagger song Just Another Night using the Tone Color Alchemy system. I enjoyed that so much that I immediately began thinking of other songs I would like to hear Ezra talk about. One song in particular came up in my mind again and again. That was Lou Reed's Paranoia, Key of E. However, I couldn't think of how this song would fit into any particular theme we had planned to cover on any of the synchronized episodes Andras and I had thus far considered. Then, when Lou Reed died in the middle of the Bridge School benefit concert, I knew what the context was. The time was right, or perhaps a tad too late. Either way, you'll now hear Ezra's take on the song in a moment. First, I'd like to point out a synchronicity between the theme of headlessness that Douglas Bowles just spoke of and this particular song. Paranoia Key of E is off Lou Reed's Ecstasy album, which features Lou's head on the cover with a red line seemingly cutting off his head or displaying it on a platter a la John the Baptist. I have also connected headlessness to a loss of ego, another node that Ezra touches on in the essay you're about to hear. For more of Ezra's work, please visit tonecoloralchemy.com or his new site, zebratale.net. That's zebra, TALE.net.
Okay, we're going to take a look at Lou Reed's song Paranoia Key of E and deconstruct its lyrical symbolism using the Tone Color Alchemy method. Keep in mind as a caveat that similar to practicing the art of dream interpretation, the technique I'm using here is designed to help draw meaning out from the song. I don't believe that the meaning I derive is a literal translation of the songwriter's intended message, but it does amplify and clarify the meaning of his song, and so that's why we do it. So here we go. The song's title includes the phrase Key of E, so right away I took this as a signpost for where I ought to begin. According to the Tone Color Alchemy map, there's 3 tarot cards in the major arcana that correspond to the musical note E. The first 2 cards are the Fool and the Magician. Lou Reed sings, "How come you say you will and then you won't? You change your mind and then you say you don't." In romantic relationships, the magician archetype expresses itself as a clear and direct will to love, whereas the fool appears detached and noncommittal. Both of these attitudes are psychological modes that exist within all of us in potential, and it depends on how we choose to relate to our environment which ones show up. The lyrics continue, "The mystery is why I play the goat, the mystery you call love." Experiencing her uncertainty, the mystery she calls love, Lou Reed plays the goat, a traditional symbol of the adversary. In tarot imagery, the devil card features a goat-headed demon perched upon a box, with the lovers bound to him by chains. Referencing the song lyrics, it's as if Lou Reed has dissociated from his human ego, and he's become identified with this Dark Lord character, which is really, in some ways, the transcendental element of their dysfunctional relationship. It's his attempt to retain a feeling of control over the situation. Later in the song, Lou sings that patricide is in the key of A. The lyrics are patricide A, matricide D, the same schizos. In Tone Color Alchemy, the musical note A is associated with the devil card. And as we know from Freud's famed theory of the Oedipal complex, paranoid schizophrenics are often suffering from a desire to kill their father. Since paranoia has appeared in the relationship channel between Lou and his lover, I couldn't help but wonder if this disharmony is somehow connected to a mistrust of masculine authority, either on her part, his, or both. He goes on singing, Sometimes you're like an eagle, strong like a rock. Other times it seems you get unlocked, and all your worst fears come tumbling out into the street, into the snow. Here again, we encounter a polarity in the attitude of his lover, this time alternating between strength and fear. The lover's strength is likened to an eagle and a rock, an interesting choice of metaphors when viewed through the lens of tarot symbolism, where the fool leaps from these snow-capped mountains with a bag slung over his right shoulder. This bag is sealed with the image of an eagle, and contains within it the magical weapons of the magician, tools which he could benefit from and accomplish his true will with. A spilling out of these contents would be the fool's worst nightmare, though, because it would challenge him to take responsibility for his actions. In Lou Reed's song, the lover's foolish paranoia invokes the presence of the devil in their relationship. So returning to the devil card, we find the demon not only has the head of a goat, but also the legs and claws of an eagle. The strength of the eagle seems to be connected to the devil, which keeps the magical implements of the magician locked up in the fool's bag. Her worst fear would be to take responsibility for her role in the co-creative process of their relationship. She prefers to play the fool, drawing upon the strength of the devil, the power of ignorance. Not knowing whether he's cheating on her or not, she entertains the idea as a possibility and becomes possessed by the fear that it could be true. This fear is rooted in ignorance, and it feeds the energy of the devil. Twice in the song, Lou Reed sings that patricide is in the key of A and matricide is in the key of D. These two keys exist in what musicians call a dominant-tonic relationship, a musical dynamic of tension and resolution. Knowing that the keys of D and A are the two easiest to play on the guitar, I was imagining Lou sitting down to write the song, thinking about this awful romance he's chained to, trying to convey through metaphor the murderous rage of their energetic connection. As he goes on with the song, he begins associating every imaginable mental illness with each of the musical keys, an irreverent attitude that could make my tone color alchemy interpretation start to seem a little bit absurd, like an intellectual exercise. He even goes so far as to make up a chord, the key of K. What am I supposed to do with that? However, I wanted to point out an insight that Lou kind of fails to illustrate in the conclusion of his song, a solution that's encoded into the third tarot card associated with the key of E, the strength card. In this image, we witness a woman gently holding open the mouth of a ferocious lion. Lou has responded to her foolishness by playing out the role of the beast, the devil. So what happens when she steps into her power? By opening up the bag, taking ownership of the magical implements, and applying the will of feminine love to the roaring beast of their mutual insanity, she breaks the spell of paranoia, setting him free to mirror that love back to her. The symbol of liberated lovers appears in the lover's card, corresponding to the tone color D orange. Since matricide was initially attributed to D, it makes perfect sense that by her stepping into the embodiment of the divine feminine, she would break the spell, reversing the matricide instinct and bringing back the great mother to life. In this configuration, as a divine mirror of her sacred feminine energy, Lou Reed would have no choice but to embody a similar reversal of roles, the undoing of patricide, ending the reign of the devil over the lovers. When you compare the devil card of the tarot to the lover's card, it's easy to see the similarities. The lovers are a liberated form of the devil's captives. The sun is the other card associated with the tone color D orange, and as the classic astrological image of the divine masculine, the sun, we receive the synchronistic confirmation through this image that the curse of the devil has been broken. Two naked children, one male, one female, are dancing beneath the sun with an expression of joy on their face, brought about by the grace of love and faith on the part of the divine feminine, the strength.
I remember everything. And everything you see is wrong. You said we'd meet, but you're 2 hours late. You said you thought someone had hit your gate, so you hid and were afraid to wait. Seeing shadows in the snow. Seeing shadows in the snow. Now your friend Godfrey is a perfect choice. 1 minute down, next time rejoice. He seems to have found the perfect voice. Paranoia key of me. Let's say everything he says is true. You love me, but I cheat on you. And in my bedroom is a female zoo. Worse than Clinton in prime time. I swear to you, I'm not with Jill or Joyce, or Sid or Sherry or Darlene or worse. I'm not kissing you while inside I curse. Paranoia key of E. Let's play a game next time we meet. I'll be the hands and you'll be the feet. And together we will keep the beat to paranoia key of E. Now, psychosis in the key of C. Let's hope that we're not meant to be in paranoia key of E. Anorexia is in G flat, and F is anything I've left out. Dyslexia, kleptomania, and vertigo. Matricide A, matricide D, the same schizos. Paranoia key of E. Let's have a coda in a key of K. Something that only we can play. Maybe we'll light up like 100K. Paranoia out of key. Paranoia key of E. Paranoia key of E.
I had made the point that I felt partially responsible both on a practical level, but also on a sort of what I called a sloppy chaos magic level of, you know, with the chosen songs, with the archetypes that we were pulling and stuff like that. Do you think there's anything to that? I asked you that question that day, and I don't know if I ever got really a sufficient answer from you. What do you think of the intent, or whether conscious or unconscious, that we put into this? And do you feel like there was any other synchronicities around that?
I thought the most powerful synchronicity of the night, as someone who's hosted hundreds, if not, you know, at least maybe, I don't know, probably not a thousand, maybe over 1,000 Radio 8 Ball shows, that sometimes the sync not chosen is the great sync. And in this case, we have 8 songs on the board and only 7 were chosen for reasons of timing and what was legally possible in the venue we were in. And so one song didn't get chosen. And for me, as a connoisseur of the subtlety of syncs in Radio 8 Ball, having a song not chosen is a profound sync. And this song happened to be Ira Marlowe's song Cemetery, which coincided so perfectly with the stage that we were on that it struck me as really powerful. And so I asked him actually after the show, once all the mics had stopped rolling and everyone was just hanging out eating pizza and drinking before the altercation, confrontation, whatever we're calling it, I asked him to sing the song. And his song, the song is "Don't Go in the Cemetery, Don't Go in the Cemetery, Don't Go in the Cemetery After Dark." I think after he played it, we were all sort of stunned by the perfection of that this hadn't been chosen, and now he's singing about not going into the place that's scary. Don't pick the eighth song. And this made me see that we don't always have to do eight songs, and that we can get a really interesting reading from the songs not chosen. And so while the song itself may be saying, don't go in the cemetery, to me it's like in Rudyard Kipling's story about how the elephant got his trunk. It's like the boring haters of the tribe, who are a lot of them old or old in their hearts and old in their souls, telling the little elephant, don't ask what the alligator has for lunch. Don't ask, don't ask, don't ask. And then, of course, he goes, or maybe it's breakfast or whatever. You know this story?
No.
He's this precocious elephant, and he asks these questions to all his elders, and they all spank him and say, don't ask this question, which is, what does the crocodile have for breakfast or lunch or whatever he has? And eventually, he goes down to the banks of the great gray, greasy Limpopo River or whatever it is, and he eventually asks the crocodile, and the crocodile tries to get him closer, and it's a scary thing, and then he grabs his nose, and he pulls, and he pulls, and he pulls, and he pulls, and eventually he pulls his way back, but his nose is huge, and he's very embarrassed about it, and he goes back to the tribe of all the animals, and they're like, what happened to your nose? And he just beats the shit out of him with it. He spanks them all with his big nose, and he loves it. And now the elephant's awesome because he has a trunk, because he asked the difficult questions. And so even though the song says don't go in the cemetery, you know, come on, if you're going to say don't go in the cemetery, of course we're going to go in the cemetery.
We were joking that it was like a horror movie. This is why Andres wanted to record this on Halloween. It was like, it's the horror movie where you're watching someone and they're like, oh my god, there's some creepy basement in our new house. We should go down there. No, don't go down there. It's probably haunted. No, we should totally check it out. We'll just go down for a minute. It was like,
not while the theremin's playing.
Right. So there's another synchronicity here is that they just had Mark Golding on 42 Minutes this week. He's the gentleman who had done the mandalas for Sync Book Volume 2. And his whole Sync Book chapter is about him sort of facing the darkness. He actually took some acid, went into the forest at night, got the shit scared out of him, and came out the other side a magician. And so there's definitely this value of, if you're going to go in, then you really got to go in and face it.
Wow, it got dark so fast.
Let's go this way.
I don't want to go in there.
What, are you scared?
No, it's just...
Come on, let's go.
Don't go in the cemetery. Don't go in the cemetery. Don't go in the cemetery after dark. Old Mr. Frank died when he drank a bottle of poison that tasted like honey. Alison Tate succumbed when she ate an old tuna sandwich that smelled kind of funny. Don't go in the cemetery. Don't go in the cemetery after dark. Martin McGriff fell off a cliff. You can still hear his terrible scream to this day. Anthony Lane was hit by a train. We all know the train tracks are no place to play. Phineas Fitch was handsome and rich, sipping champagne when he dropped from his yacht. Solomon Schwartz was covered with warts, said to be harmless, apparently not.
Over here. Don't go, sir. Don't go.
I want to tell you something.
a pimple that grew on the end of his nose. Old Mrs. Hill passed away from a chill. If only she'd slept with a window closed. Frederick Clive died in 1905 from a whooping cough. He still ticked off. There's a terrible town under the ground. Spirits and zombies and querulous ghosts. During the day, some say it's okay, but at night, keep away, keep away, keep away. No, they're not the most gracious of hosts.
There are numerous reasons. Perhaps they're obvious to you.
Don't go in the cemetery.